Coming up on Boston Public Radio, our first hour is dedicated to the life and work of Nelson Mandela. You'll hear him at the Esplanade in Madison Park High School when he visited Boston in 1990. We'll talk to South African-born former Chief Justice Margaret Marshall, former Mayor Ray Flynn, who welcomed Mandela to Boston, others who knew and experienced him, and you.
Emily Rooney on Nelson Mandela, too. She saw him in Boston. Also, the unraveling of a racism story in Lunenburg. She'll comment on that. Plus, our news quiz is comedian Chris Todd versus Corey Manning in a comedic smackdown. That's all coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
I think everyone would agree that Nelson Mandela has left a profound mark on the world. Boston was fortunate enough to be part of that global imprint. I'm sure you all remember Massachusetts became the first state to withdraw its pension fund investments from companies that did business with South Africa. City of Boston soon followed. And as the birthplace of the American Revolution, as well as the abolition movement, Mandela's visit was enormous, but likely meant more to us than it did to him. Today, we'll remember Mandela, including his trip to Boston, with a collection of interviews from people who were part of that day and from others whose lives were changed by Mandela, and with you at 877-301-8970.
You know what I think about on days like this?
What's that?
Well, you think about how most of us live our lives. You know, someone cuts us off in traffic. We go absolutely ballistic. We have to wait in line for 10 minutes on hold on the phone. We can't take it. And we're all reading about now a man who spent 27 years in prison and comes out without anger, without bitterness, and works to restore freedom in his country. I mean, you know, it makes you think that you have to try a little bit harder. You know what I'm saying, Jim?
Well, you know, but for those who say he had no bitterness, we're going to play a wonderful interview that Bill Clinton gave to CBS saying that he asked Mandela on the phone one late night whether or not there was hate in his heart. And you'll be interested to hear what Mandela told him. Speaking of Nelson Mandela and his visit, though, to Boston, obviously he spoke at the Esplanade during his visit here in 1990. Here he is talking about how welcome he felt in our city.
Sisters and brothers, given the illustrious history of this city, it is only natural that we consider ourselves as visiting our second home.
He'd been released from prison, by the way, just 4 months before that day. A little bit later, you're going to hear a discussion we had with Mayor Ray Flynn, who was his host when he was here. And Flynn tells a great story about his interaction, his meaning Mandela's interaction with the crowd that day at the Esplanade. We're going to talk to a coach who was there the day that Nelson Mandela spoke at Madison Park High. But we'll start first with this amazing conversation. Joining us on the line is the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, Margaret Marshall. Margaret Marshall grew up in a small South African village. She came to the U.S. as a high school exchange student just as the civil rights movement was heating up. When she returned to South Africa, she took the spirit of the civil rights movement with her, joining the National Union of South African Students, where she attended the trials of anti-apartheid activists, including the lawyer who had represented Mandela. Justice Marshall, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Marjorie. I'm delighted to join you again.
Thank you. And we're delighted that you're here, Justice Marshall. You know, you've talked in interviews about what it was like growing up in that small village in South Africa, not being able to speak out, books being banned. Tell us a little bit about that.
South Africa in the mid-1960s, when Nelson Mandela, he wasn't president, was sentenced to life imprisonment. It was one of the most draconian times in South Africa's long history of racial oppression. Every political party that opposed the government had been banned, including the African National Congress. Many of its leaders had to, escape into exile or had been arrested or tortured or put to death. And Nelson Mandela came within a millimeter of being sentenced to death. I think at the end of the trial, which was essentially a trial of political views, political strategy, everybody, I think, his legal team and indeed even he, thought that he would be executed, And the judge, it was in the discretion of the judge, sentenced him to life imprisonment. And it was then that he gave that extraordinary statement that was repeated by President Mandela yesterday, explaining that he had certain principles, certain ideals, and that he was prepared to die for those ideals. I had just returned from the United States as a young student inspired by President Kennedy and the claims of the civil rights movement here, and I can remember that it never occurred to us that we would ever see this man again. We thought he had disappeared forever, because at that time, apartheid, the government was this juggernaut. It was the richest country in Africa. It had the biggest military. It was the biggest military power. There were no rights. Black South Africans couldn't travel in their own country. They were denied access to higher education. They were not allowed to speak. I mean, the only reason why we knew anything about what was happening in that trial was because there was still a little loophole in the law that said that newspapers could report on the trial proceedings. Otherwise, we would have known nothing. The newspapers couldn't quote so-called banned persons. It was really a frightening, terrifying time. And yet, even at that time, when he was a young man, he spoke with such assurance and was so clear in his message, and his message remained the same throughout his life. He said at that time that he believed in harmony and a free society with all persons living together with equal opportunities. So even then, he was, in a sense, not embracing those who imprisoned him, those who had engulfed his life in such hatred, but he nevertheless, even at that extraordinary moment, I mean, he did not say, I'm not guilty. What he said was, this is what I believe in. And that, I think, is what makes him such an extraordinary human being.
You know, Justice Marshall, you talked about Nelson Mandela as a young black man. Let's talk about you as a young white girl growing up in South Africa. What was it like for you, for your family, for your, what was it like?
It was Jim, it was a pretty frightening time. My family were not a political family. White South African women, with a few exceptions, really didn't engage in political activities. I certainly, especially when I became president of the National Union of South African Students, would literally fear that I would wake up, as I've said oftentimes, you know, to the knock in the middle of the night and then just disappear. Many of my fellow student leaders had been imprisoned, had been arrested, had been banned. That was a terrible thing for a young person. If you were banned, it meant that you couldn't visit a university campus. You couldn't be in any gathering with more than one person, nowhere, not even in your own home. So you couldn't go to movies. You couldn't go to shopping centers. I mean, it was essentially house imprisonment. And I would add, Jim, and this is terribly important, that as much as I feared that and as much as the system prevented me from doing extraordinary things, it was far, far worse for black South Africans. Far worse. I mean, I could go to university. I could travel in my own country. I had access. There was no television because the South African government did not want to have the influence of foreign, you know, American broadcasting or British broadcasting, which is what would have happened. So it was very, very isolating. And yet for black South Africans, it was so much worse. I lived, you know, I had food on my table, I had clothes on my back, and for many South Africans, those privileges were not available. And in this, the richest country in Africa at the time,
Justice Martin.
Yeah.
Oh,
go
excuse
ahead,
me. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
I just
wonder when you talk about this, these strictures on the press, were you aware of, or were people in general aware of a lot of these things? White South Africans that were, I mean, you were subject to the, as you said, the knock on the door and disappearing in the middle of the night because of your political activities. But did people understand how bad this was in general?
I think white South Africans had a kind of blindness. Of course, we didn't know from the press, but it was right in front of you.
Okay.
I mean, it was right in front of you. If you simply opened your eyes, you could see. You could see how, you know, black South Africans were treated. You knew, for example, most white families, mine included, had black servants. And we knew that the mother would live in pretty dismal quarters in white homes, you know, at the bottom of the garden, quite literally, with no hot and cold, you know, there was water, but frequently, you know, no toilet, just a hole in the ground. Of this, of very wealthy homes. And you knew that they couldn't have their husband live with them or their child live with them. There was no housing for black people in so-called white areas. If you traveled around the country, as I did with my family, you would get to an isolated, you know, I was living in this very isolated part of South Africa, and we'd come to a gate in the road. We might be visiting friends who are farmers, and there would be these young black children practically naked, you know, begging for a penny. A penny was about a cent. And just to open the gate for us. I mean, you couldn't not see, and yet white South Africans did not see, didn't choose to see. And I think that white South Africans, in some respect, were no different than what often happens to people. You just don't see. And I think in some ways that is what made it both so painful in South Africa and so extraordinary. That when he was released, Nelson Mandela reached out his hand, not just to political leaders, but to everybody, to absolutely everybody. And, you know, everybody says he was in prison for 27 years, and I like to think, where was I 27 years ago? Where were your listeners 27
yeah.
years ago? And think of what has happened. Think of his family life. Think of, you know, parents and loved ones who died. We know that, then the 27 years takes on a real meaning. And as I say, nobody expected to see him again.
Well, speaking of see him again, what was it like in 1990 for you, for a woman who had spent so much of her life engulfed in the work of Nelson Mandela and the life of South Africa, when you finally got to shake his hand and meet him? I think it was in 1990 when he came here. What was that like for you, Margaret Marshall?
Oh, Jim, you know, there were really two things that I remember very well. The first was sitting in Cambridge with my husband, Tony Lewis, watching, as we all did, until he was released from prison. You may not remember that morning. You're old enough to remember, Jim. We waited, you know, for an hour or so as Ted Koppel and various other people sort of, you know, kept waiting. And, of course, we had no idea what he looked like. I mean, think of the pictures we've seen.
True. That's true.
The last few days, this young man with a sort of afro, with a middle parting, and the person who emerges from prison is this elegant, elderly man with a straight backbone, walking gently into the crowd. I can remember the tears just flowing down my cheeks. So when Tony and I went to South Africa just a few weeks later, we went to the offices of the African National Congress, which is where he was, very modest offices. He was not a head of state. There was not a great deal of security. In fact, to my recollection, there was almost no security. There were a group of people waiting to see him, and that, in some ways, that was wonderful because many of the people who were waiting to see him hadn't seen each other for 20 or 30 years either. They were all sort of former heads of the liberation movement, and they'd been in London or Timbuktu, or they'd been in prison, and there was a sort of, as each person walked into this waiting room, and they weren't very many, maybe 10, 15, 20, they just greeted each other with such emotion, and then Tony and I went in and spent about an hour and a half he was still Nelson Mandela, Mr. Mandela. It was an extraordinary experience.
What was it like? I mean, what was the physical? By the way, I made a mistake before. I thought you met him when he came to Boston. I didn't realize you would return to South Africa.
I did see him again in Boston, of course.
What was the? Do you remember the feeling when the door opens and all of a sudden you see this man for the first time and then get to touch him? I mean, what was that like?
It was I was almost speechless, and you've known me long enough to know that I'm seldom speechless. I'm seldom speechless. And yet he immediately made us feel at home, and what he said immediately was he turned to Tony and he said, "Thank you for all of the support that you've given my movement, our people, over the years." And he turned to me and he said, "And you were a very courageous young woman." I mean, it's very hard to follow that up. And I have only one regret. As I say, Tony and I were there for about an hour and a half. And I had my little camera, whatever. We didn't have iPhones in those days.
No.
Smartphones. And as we were about to leave, there was an assistant who kept coming in, signaling to him that he had to move on to the next, the next meeting. And he paid no attention to that until he was finished. And as we got up to leave, I said to him, "Mr. Mandela, may I take a photograph with you and my husband?" "Of course," he said. And so we have one picture of Mandela with Tony, one picture of me with Tony. And when we were with friends that evening and thereafter, they said, "Why didn't you take 100 pictures?"
Good question.
I couldn't. It would have seemed so selfish, so demeaning of him. I just wanted to listen. And Tony, of course, was not, a photographic journalist, so he was writing. I mean, Tony was, asking him various questions. He was thoughtful. He had nobody else in the room. He was confident. He took one or two phone calls. We sort of indicated to him, "Would you like us to leave?" "Of course not." Some of them were, quite politically sensitive telephone calls, and yet he completely trusted Tony. He's a New York Times reporter, and he never said to Tony, "Now, you won't print that, will you?" He just assumed.
We're talking with Chief Justice Margaret Marshall, and she's talking about meeting Nelson Mandela with her husband, Tony Lewis, who was a great reporter and columnist for the New York Times. I wonder, the $64,000 question, Chief Justice Marshall, is how Mandela did come out of prison after 27 years without the spite, without seeking revenge against his oppressors. You've been an attorney for many years. You've been a judge for many years. What do you think enabled him to be kind of rise above all that hatred?
I think there are two explanations, and I, hesitate even to offer these. First of all, it was a personal quality he had. So, as I mentioned, that the statement that he made when he was sentenced, before he was sentenced, when he could have been sentenced to death, he was already building for the future. But he obviously had some personal charisma, some personal qualities that elevated him to leadership, and he shared those qualities with, South African, black South Africans who had very distinguished leadership positions. It's a quality that is reflected in quite a lot of leadership. It's a quality reflected in Chief Albert Luthuli, who preceded President Mandela, as head of the African National Congress, and who himself received a Nobel Prize. It's reflected in Archbishop Tutu, who himself received a Nobel Prize. I mean, I don't want to say it's in the gene pool or in the water pool, but there's something of that.
Yeah.
Second, Nelson Mandela was a very, very sophisticated politician. Very. And there were the personal qualities, but there were also political objectives. He was in prison for political objectives, and he kept those objectives ahead of him. And he knew that for South Africa to succeed, somehow, to avoid a civil war, you had the small, extremely powerful, extremely wealthy, extremely well-armed white minority and a majority of people who were denied all fundamental rights. And I think he saw, and the white South African population was not, you know, comparatively speaking, it was not a new population. My, you know, parents and grandparents had lived there, and there were others that had lived there for a couple of hundred years. And so it was not as if it was a colonial society in the contemporary 20th century. It had many aspects of colonialism, but people had lived there for decades and centuries, white people. And I think he saw and he understood, that for South Africa to survive in the future, he was going to have to move in that direction. And he devoted his life to that. I also want to remind you, if I can, just quickly.
Sure.
You know, we all know him now. I mean, I was, of course, was watching the news last night and, you know, watching, you know, it just went on for hours and hours and hours. And so we all know him, but for 27 years almost, he was a forgotten person, not to, you know, people in the struggle in South Africa, but to the world.
Right.
To the world. I mean, if you had mentioned his name, it would not have fallen off the lips of, you know, most Americans or people living around the world. And he really did move the world. He really did move the world. And he did it with such grace, such humility, such strength, and with a vision, the peace that I, you know, that means so much, that resonates with me, is that he continued his life's journey year after year, decade after decade, into a new century. And as we mourn his death, the fact that he lived to 95 years old, was reunited with his family, watched his children and grandchildren grow up, had an extremely happy marriage with Gracia Machel. I mean, he deserved every piece of that. And it was just wonderful to know that he'd had an opportunity to do that.
Justice Marshall, we can't thank you enough for your time. We really appreciate your sharing part of your day with us.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Marjorie.
Thank you, Justice
Bye-bye.
Marshall. And that was, of course, the voice of Justice Margaret Marshall, the former Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, in a pretty incredible interview. She was wonderful, wasn't she?
She took my breath on a whole variety. I mean, from the most mundane thing where she said, you know, no one had any idea what he was going to look like. It isn't like the public had seen him in 27 years. And when you see the photos, as she says, or the videos of him prior to going to prison, and she described it perfectly, it's one thing. And then this regal old man comes out, and as she said, with the perfect posture, with that steel spine standing up proudly. It's just, it is really, and when she described what it was like in South Africa, it's one thing to read about it.
Yes.
It's another thing to talk to somebody who lived through it.
And also, as she said today, and she said many times before, that she was from an apolitical family and grew up without not really being involved in politics. And then she came to the United States at the start of the Civil Rights Movement and was listening to Walter Cronkite on television at night with the family that she was with, and everybody was debating the political questions of the day and criticizing the government, which is something that was unheard of back at home. And then she goes back at home and becomes an activist herself, going into these courtrooms, sitting, of course, in the whites-only section to watch the trials of some of these other anti-apartheid leaders. It's unbelievable.
If you have any memories, particularly if you were around in 1990 and were either at Madison Park, we're going to speak to someone who's at Madison Park High School in a little bit, or we're on the Esplanade. You can give us a buzz at 877-301-8970. But in light of the fact you asked Chief Justice Marshall about where he found that strength, that resolve to forgive. And you made the comment even earlier, prior to her being on at the top of the show, Bill Clinton did this great interview with CBS's Scott Pelley. He talked about Mandela's advice to Chelsea Clinton, which was really charming, and his lessons on forgiveness. Listen to this. We'll get to it. Actually, we're looking for it. We'll get to it in a couple of seconds. He talks about he would have late night conversations with Mandela because Clinton
was up in the middle of the night
because,
all the time.
Well, because of the time difference, and if Chelsea was still awake, depending on how late it was in the United States, Mandela in every conversation would ask to speak to Chelsea Clinton, and you'll hear why when we find the tape in a couple of seconds. Here it is. My apologies for this. Here is Bill Clinton speaking to CBS's Scott Pelley.
And we used to do business together on the phone where the time difference was so great, I would take the call at night. And if it wasn't too late, Mandela would make me go get Chelsea every time he called, and he would talk to her and ask her if she was doing her homework. I asked him once, I said, "Now, Mandela, you're a great man, but you're a wily politician. It was good politics to put your jailers in your inauguration and put the heads of the parties that imprisons you and your government. But tell me the truth. When you were walking to freedom the last time, didn't you hate him?" He said, "Yes. Briefly, I did. I hated them, and I was afraid. I hadn't been free in so long. And then I realized if I still hated them after I left, they would still have me. I wanted to be free. And so I let it go." He said, "That's what you have to do. That's what we all have to do."
When you were walking to freedom, didn't you still hate him?
Well, that was a great little detail.
That was so great.
He did invite one of his wardens to his inauguration.
Oh.
And he introduced his white jailers as his honor guard as he went through this transformation in prison. I mean, it is unbelievable, Jim. Could be a lesson there for some of us.
Well, I would say a lesson for virtually everybody. But the point that Clinton just made is that Nelson Mandela said to him, "I remain in prison, a figurative prison, forever if I allow hate to." I mean, it is so staggering. And, you know, I mentioned last night on television, we all use the word hero so constantly. It's lost its meaning. This was a hero of epic proportions. There is no one on the planet, in my estimation, who has lived a life like this man lived.
Well, another one of his great quotes about overcoming the hatred and forgiveness and stuff, when he compared grievance and resentment to, quote, "drinking poison and then hoping it will kill your enemies." Of course, it just poisons you. And there's a lot of great quotes online. If you look up the quotes of Nelson Mandela, they're really fantastic.
You heard us, a conversation we had earlier this morning with Margaret Marshall. We had a number of those with people who had interactions with or done work in and around Nelson Mandela. Here's one with a guy you know who had a chance encounter with Mandela, not in South Africa, but elsewhere. Listen. Joining us on the line is the Reverend Eugene F. Rivers III. He's the co-founder of Boston's 10-Point Coalition. Hey there, Reverend Rivers.
Hello, hello, Mr. Browdy and Ms. Deegan.
good morning.
Hey,
good morning, Reverend Rivers. So, Gene, I understand you had that you actually ran into a Nelson Mandela in South Africa. Is that correct? What happened?
No, actually, it was a chance encounter in Harare. It was Southern Africa. It was in Harare, Zimbabwe. At the Harare Sheraton Hotel in the lobby. It's amazing. I'm in the lobby. I was giving a presentation for the World Council of Churches, and we're in the lobby, and I'm there with our 7-year-old daughter, Sojourner. I see a fleet of very important-looking cars, you know, with flags on them, the whole business, pull up to the hotel. And so, you know, me being me, I'm curious. As it turns out, you know, the military guys come in and do the official thing, and Nelson Mandela, President Nelson Mandela, and President Robert Mugabe come into the hotel.
Wow.
It was amazing. So I'm there, and being with Sojourner, my baby, right? And I said, my baby's going to meet Nelson Mandela. Sorry, right? President Mandela, would you shake my daughter's hand, right? And I sort of nudge Sojourner. He says, yes, of course. He stops with Mugabe there, and in the most... You know, he's got the irresistible smile. He's got this paternal quality, you know, where he's just this fatherly figure, right? And he stops and he shakes Sojourner's hand and the hand of a little girl that was with her. Oh, it was amazing. And it was such he's a regal figure. He's very dignified. But he put that smile on for Sojourner, who was scared because he was a towering guy to her, right? It was an amazing chance occurrence. you know, this iconic, legendary figure. And it was astounding. It was absolutely amazing.
I bet you didn't ask Mugabe to shake her hand, but that's for another day. Hey, Jean Rivers, yes. did your kid, when she was seven, I mean, obviously she didn't understand the full impact of Nelson Mandela in the world. Did she get who he was then?
Well, a couple of things. One, we had talked about Mandela, you know, because Mandela was one of the heroes, right? I mean, literally, Mandela was a troublemaker, right? He was a troublemaker, so he was my kind of guy. And so Malcolm and Sojourner, right? It, you know, both heard about South Africa, Nelson Mandela, the apartheid struggle. So that had been sort of like almost dinner table kind of discussions of, you know, black figures and black politics in South Africa. So this is President Mandela from the African National Congress, ANC. And Sojourner, you know, being in the Rivers household, she was reading all kinds of communist literature as soon as we could guarantee that she could hold the book, right? So, and, you know, Mandela was one of the figures.
So she got it.
Malcolm X, I mean, the whole pantheon of iconic black revolutionary figures.
Well, yeah, speaking of that,
so she did.
She got you. I got a text from you at 1:53 in the morning. I was not awake, but I read it this morning. And here's the final line. I'd like you to explain it to people listening. He was not South Africa's Martin Luther King. What do you mean by that, Jane Rivers?
In fact, the text was, as we celebrate and commemorate the life, my point was, it's important not to bleach Mandela.
Meaning
and
what?
Domesticate him. By which I mean, Mandela is this unbelievable figure of the 20th century. He was a black revolutionary who called for armed resistance against a totalitarian society. That's one phase. He then is a political prisoner for 27 years. And then he is one of the peerless statesmen of the 20th and 21st century, right? Because he's a voice of reconciliation. So here's a guy who calls for armed resistance and guerrilla warfare against a totalitarian state. He is then a political prisoner for 27 years. And then he is this unbelievably brilliant statesman who promotes racial reconciliation at a time when the hardliners wanted blood. It's astounding. You know, I mean, one can't exaggerate how extraordinary these political accomplishments were. And my point was, this was a tough guy. He was a black revolutionary figure who called for armed resistance and went to Algeria to learn how to make bombs.
But
and
he
then becomes this voice of reconciliation.
But he obviously, as Desmond Tutu has said, transformed in prison.
Well, that's Gene's point, right?
Yeah, he came out a different guy than when he went in. I mean, maybe it was age, maybe it was time.
I would say he was more brilliant than that. I don't think that he was just reformed. He was brilliant in that he understood that for South Africa to become a democratic, multiracial society, that revenge, retribution, was not a political option he had. That, to me, is brilliant. In addition to making white people feel better, it was more fundamentally the ingenious insight that made him a leader above all other leaders, in that he told his party to stand down and that retribution and vengeance was not an option. That's amazing.
That is amazing. Gene Rivers, co-founder of the 10-Point Coalition. Great to talk to you, Gene. Thanks for your time.
Bless you, guys.
See you.
Thank you, Gene. Okay, we're going to be back with much more on the life of Nelson Mandela, including an interview with Ray Flynn, the mayor who welcomed Mandela to Boston. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. We're spending the first hour and then a little more talking about the life and work and legacy of Nelson Mandela. Joining us on the phone line, this is actually great, is Coach Dennis Wilson. In 1990, when Mandela visited Madison Park High School right here in Boston, Coach Wilson was a history teacher, dean of discipline, and the basketball coach. You may know Coach Wilson. This is how I met him, from the documentary film that he and Rudy Hippolyte made about Madison Park High's basketball team called Push Madison versus Madison. Coach, it's been a long time. It's great to speak to you.
Jim, always a pleasure. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
Hi, Coach Wilson. Thank you for joining us. So tell me, Mandela was late that day to Madison Park, was he not? I mean, what was it like?
Well, there was so much energy in that building that day. You know, just knowing that you were going to have the opportunity to see one of the most unbelievable and amazing individuals on the face of the earth. And that moment, I'll never forget it. It was one of the most amazing moments and impacting moments in my life, other than my son Tyreek being born. I would say in the Million Man March, that definitely is at the top. And there was a packed house. Everybody was, the atmosphere was electric. Everybody was excited. You know, just the buzz, buzz, buzz. And every 5 minutes you see movement. And people were kind of, is that him? Is that him? And then finally, when the moment finally came, when Mazi came up on stage with a small entourage and the crowd just went crazy. And, you know, it just is the moment that I'll never, ever forget.
Coach Wilson, do you want to hear a little bit of that moment right now?
Here, oh, wow.
I do, too. This is part of what Nelson Mandela had to say to Coach Wilson and the students and other people there. He was preaching to the crowd about not dropping out of school. Listen to what he had to say.
We are deeply concerned, both in our country and here, of the very large number of dropouts by school children. This is a very disturbing situation. The reason for our children leaving school at the very elementary standards is because of poverty and frustration. But we would like to advise you to try as much as possible to remain in school.
So, Coach Wilson, do you think anybody remained in school after listening to that? Did it have an effect, do you think, on the kids and on the teachers?
Without a doubt. Everybody left there beaming and just on a natural high, realizing that, you know, the inspirational speech, you know, he was dancing on stage. I remember everybody was dancing, and just it was just such a joyful moment, guys, that you had to be inspired by his speech, by him, his presence, and all that he spoke about, not only about, of course, you know, staying in school and the power of education, but also getting along and peace and loving one another. And it's just, again, a moment in a day that I'll never, ever forget.
We're speaking to the legendary, and I do mean legendary, basketball coach from Madison Park High.
Oh,
coach,
wow.
No, Dennis Wilson, you are, and you know it, Coach. Coach, what did it feel when you heard the news last night? I assume right around 5 o'clock like the rest of us did. What was that like for you?
You know, Jim, it's funny. You know, hearing that he hasn't been doing well. Of course, health was failing, and you know, 2 or 3 months ago, and then you're kind of saying like, oh, please, you know, you say your own personal prayer that, you know, you hope that, one, that he lives as long as you know, lives infinitely forever. And then the other piece, knowing that no one lives forever, that, you know, you just don't want to see him or his family suffer, knowing how much he means to so many people, not only in South Africa, but around the world. So constantly just kind of, you know, just keeping an eye out on how things were going. And then last night, when I finally, you know, heard it, I'll be honest with you, I just stopped and paused for a moment. And I said a personal prayer. And I said I was just so thankful to be able to have witnessed, experienced, and been a part of a very historical moment and had an opportunity to see, as I said earlier, one of the greatest people that ever walked the face of the earth that meant so much to so many people.
Don't you think, Coach Wilson, that he probably believed in those words, stay hungry, stay humble, stay focused? Do you think so?
Coach, oh, Jim, you're good, man. You're good. I got to hire you, Jim.
Hey, Coach.
I think you make here, you know.
Coach Wilson from Madison Park High School, I'm a huge fan of yours, as are so many others. Thanks so much for sharing
your
memories. We hope to talk to you soon, Coach.
Thanks for having me on, and you guys have a great holiday. We lost a great one of the legends, the icons, the great Nelson Mandela. Thank you again.
We did. Thank you, Coach
Thank
Wilson.
Thank you, Coach Wilson, from Madison Park High School.
If you haven't seen the movie, Push, Madison versus Madison, it's a topic for another day It is truly one of the greats.
I haven't seen it. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, if you'd like to share your thoughts about the life of Nelson Mandela. You know, I was reading earlier this morning that he was sick with lung issues when he was first in prison. Mm-hmm. And they were very worried that because the medical care was not what it should have been in prison, that he might die in prison. And then toward the end of his life, we know that it was a lung disease that it did finally take his life. I mean, he was 95, but the lung problem started in prison. I guess when they were working in those, the prisoners were working there, they got so much debris in their eyes from working with the lime, I believe it was, it was in their lungs and also caused their eyes to shut.
I don't think they were terribly concerned about prison conditions then.
No, they weren't.
You know, one of the amazing things of the people with whom we spoke, Coach Wilson, you'll hear our conversation with Ray Flynn in a little bit, Margaret Marshall, and some other folks, Gene Rivers, our colleague Philip Martin, the emotion in their voice is so intense. The guy was 95 years old. Everybody knew he was going to die soon, so it isn't like this was some surprise. He died at home, which obviously was a positive thing. I was in the newsroom at NECN yesterday when the news came across at roughly 5 o'clock. You know what was most incredible to me? I mean, we've only talked to people so far who had an experience with Nelson Mandela. 20-some-year-old reporters and producers who obviously weren't around for the vast majority of this and were infants at the time, if they were alive at all, when he was released from prison in 1990. The impact that this guy has had in the lives of virtually everybody is so immense. It's surreal.
Well, because you just think of, I mean, you can't help comparing yourself or the leaders of today or the most leaders you know with a man who was willing to die for what he believed in. I mean, as Margaret Marshall, the former Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court said, he thought he was going to be executed. And he gets up there and says, you know, I am willing to die for freedom for my country. I mean, how many people are willing, never mind die, go to prison for 27 years. People are, our politicians are so afraid of not winning the next election, they won't even vote on their principles. So the comparison between that and Nelson Mandela, you just think, as many people have said, we're not going to see another person like him anytime soon.
You know, for one of the people who said we won't see another person like him was Barack Obama yesterday. One of the things the president said, and I'm sure everybody's heard this, is that the first political action he was ever involved in was an anti-apartheid thing. I told you, I've never said this on the air. I was actually involved in an effort on the 350th anniversary of Harvard. There was this
I did not know that.
There was a huge, huge dinner where I assume they're going to raise zillions of dollars from some of the elite who had Harvard connections. And there was an effort to shut it down. It was a really important effort. And the reason was that Harvard had yet to divest from businesses working in South Africa. And the scene of hundreds of us, I was just one of them, blocking the doors to this regal event where people in their tuxedos and their evening dresses are standing out waiting for entry. And by the way, ultimately, Harvard had to cancel the dinner and everybody had to go home without a meal and without checks.
Anti-apartheid.
Well, I wouldn't go. Who knew exactly? In any case, we spoke a while ago to one of our colleagues who you know is a reporter now, but who listen to his story about his time in South Africa. Listen. WGBH's senior investigative reporter Philip Martin used to have the international beat. He was in South Africa in the early 90s. He's with us now. Philip, good to see you.
Hey, good to see you guys. How's it going?
Oh, it's going very well. So tell us about this story about picking up a hitchhiker. What was going on there?
Well, 2 years before the election of 94, April 94, I was in South Africa. I had actually come from Mozambique where war was going on, a civil war, a South African-supported insurgency led by a group called, included a group called RENAMO. It was actually led by intelligence forces within the South African Defense Forces. And the RENAMO was waging this war, and it brought in a number of people, a number of troops from Zimbabwe. It brought in troops from Tanzania. And they were basically winding this down. Within a week and a half, I was on a flight to Joburg. And in Joburg, I basically spent time around Soweto trying to understand what was happening in South Africa in the lead up to elections. It was hoped, because elections were never assured, by the way. There was a process toward creating an electoral electoral conditions. But what was happening in the country was there was internecine conflicts among groups within South Africa. There was a war within between the ANC and the Inkatha, which was this black nationalist, black right-wing group supported by South African security forces. So there wasn't always assured. There was also a referendum that was about to take place asking white voters if, in fact, they approved of the process toward creating elections in 1994. This passed with 69% of the white vote, by the way. But a lot of this was based on the urgency of the moment. It wasn't just a question of getting rid of a system that quite a few whites, a minority in this case, basically disagreed with. A majority still agreed in many ways because they were privileged by apartheid.
Right.
But the writing was on the wall. And so at this point, sanctions, divestment efforts, the economic conditions of that time, it was wearing South Africa down.
So this is just to put this in context. Mm-hmm. 2 years essentially after Mandela's out of prison, 2 years before the election. So you're driving along the road in and around Johannesburg. What happened?
That's Philip right. And as they say, driving on the wrong side.
It must be hard to do that.
It's hard to do that. But I'm sure you've done that in London, too.
I haven't, actually.
But anyway, outside of Joburg, I picked up a white hitchhiker. Now, you might ask, why would an African-American man in South Africa, given the conditions and the fact that there's still tension, a lot of tensions in the air, pick up a white hitchhiker? Undying curiosity. He was hitching. I picked him up. I knew there'd be a story there, and there was. This individual was very forthcoming. He was not anesthetized by, you know, like this whole thing about color blindness and so on and so forth. He was very, very direct about his views. He saw me in some ways as an exception, as an African-American, as opposed to an African. And he basically said that he feared an African National Congress, one man or one person, one vote type of situation in South Africa because he thought it would bring on communism. Don't forget, a lot of this was being fought up until this point within the context of the Cold War. And he had grown up on a steady diet that black opposition to apartheid meant communism. It didn't mean freedom. It wasn't about, you know, like improving conditions.
Yeah.
It was anti-communist.
Yeah, but Philip, you only asked one of the two questions. The one question you asked, which is, why would you stop to pick up a white guy in South Africa? Why would a white guy in South Africa take a ride from a black guy?
That is a good question, but
He needed a ride.
He was on his way to Durban. He was trying to reach Durban. But I think it's actually somewhat less complicated. Here's a person with a car. The majority of people who were still passing on the road at that point were white people, and they weren't picking him up. Philip Martin stopped and picked him up. It wasn't altruism. It was curiosity.
So what was the takeaway from your time together?
Well, he was very blunt. He just said that I had asked him how he was going to vote in the upcoming referendum, and he said, have you seen what's happened to the rest of Africa? This was his response. He says, have you seen what happened to the rest of Africa? If we vote yes on this referendum, this could happen to us in South Africa. He was truly fearful. But I think more than anything, we got a chance to talk as human beings. He wasn't objectifying me at that point because after about 20 minutes, we really, I would say within the first few minutes, of course he was. But within 20 minutes or so, we knew each other on a first name basis, though I can't recall the guy's name at this point. And we were able to basically deconstruct or talk about each other's positions.
Yeah, we only have a minute left. Let me. Uh-huh. When you're in that car with that guy in 1992, this is 2 years before, obviously, the election at which history was made. Would either you or your passenger have believed that Nelson Mandela would be the leader of South Africa so shortly after that?
I certainly believed it, but I also knew it was going to be complicated and it was going to be difficult because in South Africa, the tension was just extraordinary.
It was dangerous.
It was dangerous. And leading up to the we have this thought in our head that there was a smooth transition from Mandela being released from prison to 1994 elections. It was not. There were bombs going off. The South African
it wasn't even clear the elections were happening.
Oh, that's right. That's
forget
right.
communism for a second. Yeah. I mean, I realized that was a big concern, but also being
it was a false concern, by the way.
Being slaughtered. If you were a white person in South Africa, you were afraid that after all these years of oppression toward blacks, they'd say, "Hey, enough of this. Off with your head."
Well, that's absolutely true. Don't forget, between this time, between 1990 and 1994, a young white woman, Amy Bill, lost her life in South Africa to groups associated with the Pan-Africanist Congress.
Yep.
But during that same period, Chris Hani, who was a self-proclaimed communist, a member of the ANC, a very popular member of the ANC, was assassinated during that period. So there was a lot of violence. There was a lot of fear going on. And picking up this hitchhiker, in many ways, it was the antithesis of fear, in some ways, getting back to what Jim was saying. Because, I was not afraid to pick him up, and apparently he wasn't afraid to get into the car. There was a little hesitation on my part.
Could he tell you were an American? Were you dressing in a sort of American kind of way?
Yeah, he picked up on it right away. Okay. He had traveled.
What were you wearing, Philip? Do you remember? Khaki pants?
Probably something very unfashionable.
Okay. So, Philip, if I need a ride later, I can give you a call?
Oh, no. Those hitchhiking days are over.
Philip Martin, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, Jim Marjorie, thank you.
Thank you. You know, can you imagine living in a country like this where you were worried about forget the black people. They just had these horrific lives, as Margaret Marshall said, but the white people that were there, if you spoke out, you'd disappear in the middle of the night. I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah, I love what you said to him. Did you realize you were American? What were you wearing? When the car's zipping by on the road, do you think the white guy is saying, slow down so I can check you out and hear your accent?
No, you can always tell American men in Europe, and I'm sure you can in Africa too. They always have the same outfit on. You know, you can tell. It's harder to tell the women, but there's something very distinctive about American men, no matter where they travel. I think it's the Izod Church or something. I don't know.
Maybe it is. In any case, we spoke to one more person this morning, a pretty important person in this whole mix. He was the guy who welcomed Nelson Mandela to Boston just months after his release from prison. Here he is. Joining us on the line is the former mayor of Boston and ambassador to the Vatican, Ray Flynn. Mayor Flynn, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you, Jim and Marjorie, again.
Good morning, Mayor Flynn. So I read where you got, shortly after Nelson Mandela's release from prison, you got a phone call from him here in Boston. What was that about? What did he say to you?
Well, when I was in college, I was involved in the anti-apartheid movement. There was an organization over at Harvard Graduate School, and I knew a number of the people who were involved in that movement. And then when I became mayor, I teamed up with the city council in introducing, I think, the first ordinance in the country calling on cities not to invest with banks or insurance companies that do business with the South African government. And that passed in Boston. And then when I was president of the mayors, I introduced the same proposal, and that passed, although it was a pretty contentious debate. And then I introduced that, the same thing, at the Democratic National Convention.
Wow.
And so it had a profound impact. I didn't realize it at the time, but it had a profound impact. And then 2 days after Nelson, I corresponded with Nelson Mandela when he was in Robben Island. And I visited South Africa, too, in Robben Island.
Wait a minute. You sent letters to him, and he sent letters back to you from prison?
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah. And then when he got released from prison, I think it was the next day or 2 days later, Marjorie, he called me on the phone. And don't ask me where he got the private number, but I received a phone call from Desmond Tutu as well in Lech Walesa up in Gdansk, up in Poland. So that maybe the CIA had the telephone number or something. But anyway, he said that he was most appreciative of the people of the city of Boston. He really was so proud to the support that he received from the people of the city. And we talked about Boston and its historic commitment to human rights and social and economic justice and, you know, progressive movement in Boston and so forth. So he said, look, I want to come to the United States. And when I do, I want to come to Boston. Can we arrange that? And I says, yes, absolutely. So when he came to the United States, I think the very first stop that he made was the city of Boston, and the rest of it is history. The people in Boston just loved him. I think they loved him because they could identify with him and his struggles. You know, many of the citizens of Boston, many of whom were immigrants, blacks or Irish or Jewish or German or whatever, and they all experienced these kind of situations in their country and in coming to Boston. And that's why the people of Boston could see something very unique and special, particularly his humility and his courage.
Yeah, Ray Flynn, what did it do for Boston itself? You explained why Nelson Mandela wanted to come here, but obviously we'd experienced racial strife of our own not so long before. What impact in light of that, did Mandela's visit and his trip to Madison Park High School, his speech on the Esplanade, spending 2 days
there,
what impact did that have on the city?
Well, I'll tell you what it did, Jim. I was standing next to Nelson Mandela with Teddy Kennedy and Mike Dukakis up there on the Hat Show.
We saw you dancing, looked, Mayor Flynn.
Yeah, I didn't dance very well. I read your story here. Audrey, and I'm going to pick you up on that later on. My wife would disagree with you, by the way. I do a mean Irish jig.
Okay. I'm sorry, Mayor Flynn. Sorry.
Well, in Nelson Mandela was speaking, and I looked down at the audience. This is the truth. I looked down at the audience, and I saw white and black, young and old. Obviously, I didn't know their party affiliation or their ideology, but they were all kind of holding on to every word that Nelson Mandela said. I saw some people crying. I saw Nelson Mandela walk into the audience, make eye contact with people who waited for 5 to 6 hours just to see him, and now he was extending his hand in friendship, shaking hands with him, rubbing little kids' heads, posing for pictures. I said, this is an incredible man. I've known John Paul II since 1969. I've known Mother Teresa for the longest period of time. And I would put those two people, those two great leaders, and Nelson Mandela in the same category of those two people. Boston has been very, very fortunate to have a special relationship with John Paul II, Mother Teresa, and Nelson Mandela. All three of them not only visited Boston in their first visits to the country, but they also had a profound impact in the history of Boston. And, you know, people today, yep, they're sad. I'm sad at his passing. But you know what? I'm as proud as a peacock to know that I saw one of the great modern leaders of our day.
Hey, Ray Flynn, before you go away, we only have a minute left. I want to go back to the beginning. The correspondence when he was imprisoned, what did you say to Nelson Mandela, whom you didn't know at that point except by reputation? What were the communications like and about?
Well, I told him that, you know, we introduced this resolution, mm-hmm. and there was enormous support, despite the fact, Jim, most of the banks in the international corporations, we had several of them in Boston, and Eddie Koch down in New York had a lot of opposition to this divestment ordinance that we introduced. And even at the Democratic National Convention, there was significant opposition. And I told them about the support, the grassroots support that we got from the people. They really didn't know what the legislation did, but they felt that it was going to help end apartheid, bring justice, bring end the discrimination. And I think people really could identify with that, and they wanted to send a message not only to the people of Boston, not only to the politicians, but to the world that this was Boston.
Mm-hmm. Ray Flynn, very quick question. Were they handwritten letters, and do you still have them?
You know what? If you remember, Marjorie, there's a story in the paper, you could read it, that when they broke into my house that time, they stole letters from John Paul II that he had sent me, dear rosary beads, and they also stole a letter from Nelson Mandela. That's why I got so upset about that when my house was broken into that time.
Hey, Ray Flynn, thank you for sharing your recollections. They were terrific.
I'm going right by the White House now, Jim, in White Washington, so I'll wave out the cab window.
Well, you know what I'll do? I'll call ahead and tell the president to wave back to you, Ray.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to a party, a function for Hillary Clinton.
And, oh, great.
And Tommy Lantos is a great friend of mine. He passed away. He was the only survivor of the Holocaust that served in the United States Congress. So that's, we're honoring him today.
Terrific. Ray Flynn, former mayor, former ambassador to the Vatican. Thanks so much for your time, Ray.
Thank you very much, Mayor Flynn, for taking the time. Appreciate it.
I'm sure we will talk much more about Nelson Mandela next week. But if you missed any of the conversations we had with Philip Martin, our colleague, with the mayor of Boston at the time, Ray Flynn, with Coach Dennis Wilson, who was then the basketball coach at Madison Park High School on the day that Nelson Mandela spoke there, Reverend Eugene Rivers, and an incredible interview we had with the former Chief Justice of the State Supreme Judicial Court, Margie Marsha. They'll all be online at WGBHnews.org in fairly short order.
Up next, we're going to speak with Emily Rooney. She was on the Esplanade the day that Nelson Mandela danced on the stage. And here is the song that Nelson Mandela was feted to that day on the Esplanade. ...9.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Speaking of, what did Ann call it? Boston media royalty.
That's
here
right.
With the tiara on, or whatever you pronounce it, is our Friday open mic partner all the time, Emily Rooney. Hi, Emily.
Hey,
you look great
Jim,
in that outfit.
Hey, thank you for coming in. So you were there in 1990 on the Esplanade that we've been talking about all day long. Tell us what it was like.
You know, I was assistant news director at Channel 5 at the time. Actually, I think I was already news director, yeah, because I was named in January.
You were a honcho.
I was news royalty, even then. By then. But put it in perspective, I had just come to Boston when the Pope arrived,
yeah.
So that was a big event, the Queen's appearance here, tall ships, of course. These were all these magnificent events that we covered, you know, from dawn to dusk, you know. But they were, in some ways, much more somber events than this thing. All I can remember is sitting there, and we had a booth set up, and we had guests just coming in and out, in and out. But the whole thing was a party. It really was. I mean, from the dancing on the stage to the people we had tossing back to the commentators on the stage or side by side. I can remember Rory O'Connor, who had just completed a documentary for his outfit in New York on South Africa. And he was like our main spokesperson. And he was like wheeling around and throwing to the music on the stage. It was just a whole different kind of event.
You know what's unbelievable? First of all, he was only out of prison 4 months when this happened. And I'm so glad you said this. I think I said this to you this morning, Marjorie. Of all the video that we all watched last night, the thing that stays with me is immediately he's out of prison. His smile is as beautiful
yes.
as any
yeah.
man's have ever
yes.
seen. Dancing. Joyful. It is amazing.
And saying those things about Massachusetts,
yes.
Boston, and the New England region, about us being part of the anti-apartheid movement, you know, we were really part of that.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of that, though, one of the things that I'm curious is why I lived here. I didn't live through a lot of what I'm about to ask you about. I mean, not only was there the racial strife in Boston that preceded this, we mentioned this to Ray Flynn, there had been two votes in Roxbury to secede from Boston and call it Mandela of
yeah.
all places. So what was the sense?
And the
in
Mandela
that?
Apartments are still there, mm-hmm. right on, I think it's either Harrison
well,
Avenue or Washington Street.
You talked about this with Ray Flynn, but keep in mind that Charles Stewart murdered his wife and baby
in
October of 89.
Great point.
And he jumped off the Tobin Bridge on January 4th, 1990. So that had just happened, too. That was
we should remind people
later.
For newcomers, the town, a guy who it turned out had killed his wife, but immediately after
blamed
a black guy. What was the guy's
Bennett.
Name? Willie Bennett. Yeah.
He said that Bennett jumped in the back seat of his car and shot him and shot his wife.
Yeah.
And many of us bought it,
of course.
Frankly.
Yeah, everybody bought it. Yeah.
And sinker. And during that time, the cops in Boston, it was not a proud moment
no.
for the
rounding
police in
up,
Boston,
you know,
who went through the Mission Hill area,
yeah.
basically, practically strip searching
yep.
every single young man, mm-hmm. You know, asking them to, pressing them, their bodies for guns and weaponry and all these kinds of things. A lot of harassment of young mm-hmm. black men. It was a terrible time.
And I think Roxbury, growing up, I didn't grow up in Boston, but even where I lived in Connecticut, it had a bad name, just the sound of it. And it still has some association with that, let's face it. So the idea that it wanted to change its name, I think, had a lot of kind of popular support. I don't think it was ever going to happen because I don't know what kind of a vote it would have taken. But it probably would have been a good idea.
But so was the notion that Mandela was sort of giving a stamp of approval to the new Boston by being here? Was there that feeling after
all this?
I'm
not so sure
about
that. I think, I don't know how plugged in he was to what all was going on here, but he really felt like we were a liberal state. Mm. And as such, we embraced the ideals of, you know, what the anti-apartheid movement.
Well, it was a big deal. I mean, you mentioned your protest. Jim was over protesting Harvard before they had divested.
Well, who was? And everybody was.
Not everybody.
Not everybody. And
we were journalists, Jim.
Yeah.
I wasn't then.
You
know, yet,
not, and you are now?
Well, I am of a sort, yes.
But we were the first in Boston and Massachusetts join that whole effort.
Yeah, we were banning those Krugerrands and all that stuff.
Yes, the Krugerrands. I remember that.
Emily had to get rid of her Krugerrands. It was a horribly painful moment.
Those gold coins that you would see around the necks of women, and you had to get rid of them.
That was a big news thing with the Krugerrands.
Okay, so we're talking about Roxbury in 1990 and before. Let's talk about Roxbury today and the fact that the outgoing mayor of Boston, with 30-plus days left, is about to have his head pop off. He's ready to strangle the leaders of Partners Health, who are not relocating 4,500 employees, or at least consolidating them in Roxbury, as he had hoped and been negotiating with them, but going out to the new Assembly Square development in Somerville. What's your take on this thing?
This is just an outrage. But I got to say, in some ways, the mayor blew this, because he's been so kind and so gentle to our healthcare system, to our colleges and universities, to places like WGBH, and not twisting arms and wringing necks to get payments in lieu of taxes. He let that all go by the boards. Millions of dollars. As I always say, there's no such thing as nonprofit. Everybody makes money. That's how you stay in business. And all of these businesses should have and should be now paying some money to the city. And now this outfit, Partners, which is huge, is going to go up and leave and move to Somerville, and not having paid any payments in lieu of taxes or anything else. I think Marty Walsh has to get on this and reverse that decision.
And by the way, this is we broached this in the debate with them. This is, for those who don't understand, if you're a tax-exempt organization, you don't pay property taxes.
Right.
You pay if you're a small business or you own a house. They don't. And as a result, mayors or leaders of cities have to negotiate voluntary payments.
They still plow our roads. They still do everything for the Museum of Fine Arts. We could go right down the line.
Do you want to get aggravated, Emily? Do you know, as a Boston resident, you are.
Yeah.
Do you know that more than 50% of the property in Boston is tax exempt?
55%.
And here's his quote from the
Fisher
mayor. He's saying, Partners has an obligation to the city where they have acres and acres of tax-exempt property. This could have been an opportunity to help revitalize Roxbury. And that's a great point.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm sure the mayor over in Somerville is very happy that Partners is going there. But where needs this revitalization more? I would
argue
Roxbury
does. And they got big breaks
does.
From Boston and Mayor Mignino. He was buddy-buddy with all those guys.
Do you hear the line that I don't know if it was on our station. I heard on the radio this morning. And I love when Mignino said this. He says, this is not just about the bottom line, which is what they're deciding this based upon. It's about social justice.
Yeah.
And I agree in the context of what you're talking about and the treatment they've gotten. It really is an outrage. And the question, you say Marty Walsh has got to deal with this come January 6th. The question is Walsh weigh in now? Because Partners still has a presence here, and I assume they want to be treated decently in Boston. They've got to reciprocate.
So tell us about this big 180 turn up in Lunenburg, where the football team had been accused of racial taunts and racial epithets, and in fact of spray painting Blue Knights, that's the name of the team up there, needs no N-word on the house of one of the only players, biracial players in the whole
team. Okay, so the mother is white, the father's black, the child is biracial. This story stunk from the get-go. I don't believe it radar went right up. And, of course, it's going to end up being that it was a member of the family. It looks like all fingers are pointing at the mother. I said this to you on the phone the other night, Marjorie. Sometimes these things are so personal. They're not believable. If they had, you know, stolen the kid's bike or written something on his locker, but to spray paint somebody's house. You know, I went back and I did some research about this Concord Carlisle. I'll probably get sued for this. This Concord Carlisle student who's filing a $2 million lawsuit against the school. I don't believe her either. 24 incidents of being harassed and bullied, and she's, you know, she graduated from the school. But it sounds like, and they've checked, you know, videotapes and all this stuff. I mean,
but how do you know that? I mean, those who think that Emily is doing a one of these Monday morning quarterback things, when we were talking about Lunenburg when it originally happened, and all of American journalism, not just in Greater Boston but America, is interviewing the parents, the white mother, the black father, and buying in, as did I.
Everybody,
Emily
did
was the outlier.
Defamation,
but when you
Lee
say things
in?
Like you said about Concord, just for a second, I mean, would you have said the same thing when Phoebe Prince was being allegedly bullied. Now we know it to be true before she killed herself in South Hadley.
Both of these incidents involve something more than verbal bullying. It involves all this, you know, wreckage, like keying a car, sending messages, writing things.
Yeah, but Emily, you know, the one thing that I think keep in mind in Lunenburg, which is why I would like to say in my own defense that I did buy it hook, line, and sinker, and there's no denying this now, the football players, the football team in Lunenburg had engaged in apparently some racial taunting, playing some team
out
of Worcester. So
playing Worcester.
That's
but as
not
we know,
denied.
As we know, that goes on all the time in both major league and apparently minor league and high school locker room, so it could be it could have been more of an extension of that. I have no idea what the context of that was. This was beyond.
You know, we only have a, before we get to your list, because I know this is having your head pop off in the debate yet again with Walsh and Connolly. We asked them about this new development that was about to be approved.
Yeah.
First one in Boston history where there's no mandated parking. The theory was it was going to motivate people not to have cars in Boston. You're out of your mind over this.
Ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. 145 units. Oh, well, there's going to be no parking. Yeah. You know what? They're going to be taking the other 145 parking places that are on the street. Are these people going to have to sign a waiver? They have to get a sign, a thing that says they're not going to have a car?
I know the answer to that. The answer is no.
Of course not. They're just not going to have a legal parking space in the building.
But they're near the T. You don't think they're going to say, we'll leave our cars in Weston? No.
They need a car.
Okay, well, that's sort of the preview. You get a little taste of what's to come. Here it is, as promised, every Friday.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Yeah, you could have just stayed with the condo, but what do you got for us here?
All right. I have sort of a thematic list this week.
Go ahead.
Things I learned over my Thanksgiving Day break.
Yeah.
First of all, we already knew this, but it happened to me. Do not fall for overwrought weather forecasting because it will cost you dearly. So I'm supposed to fly out last Wednesday. I think, I'm going to miss I've never traveled on Thanksgiving. And I thought, I have to get to my sister's in Washington. I go online. And sure enough, I click the thing and I upgrade myself to a first class ticket so I can get out on Tuesday night. I don't even want to tell you what it cost me.
How much it cost?
It was a lot.
Okay, fine.
They did deduct what I had already paid for the regular thing because there was a weather advisory or something. But still, it was outrageously expensive. It was absolutely ridiculous. And of course, I would have gotten out perfectly easily. I was like, people were panicking me. Oh, delays up and down. It wasn't that bad.
How much
on the
it cost?
East Coast. A significant amount. You wouldn't have paid it. Let's put it that way.
They had a front page of the Wall Street Journal. People at the airport, hysterical.
Yeah, absolutely hysterical. All right, here's something else I learned.
Yes.
Do not pay to check your bag. Bring it with you.
I knew this
and
trick. Go ahead.
And then when you get to the thing, they'll grab it from you and check it for free.
Yeah.
For free,
I'm
like
the sucker. I pay the not on the first class thing,
of course,
on the way
not.
Back.
Yeah.
I pay the $25. I'm in line with every other, Tom, Dick, and Harry in the world. And they're carrying their double wides, as I call them, onto the plane. And they're grabbing them at the stairway. And I said, I'm being penalized for doing it the right way. And, of course, I have to speak up. I can't just let this go by.
No, of course not.
I said, I don't understand why I'm being penalized. They didn't even know what I was talking about.
How was the champagne in first class? Good?
I didn't have anything.
Good food? Mm. Don't they give you good food in
first
class?
They give you filet. They serve champagne while you're waiting to take off.
I think hors d'oeuvres?
Pretzels and a really bad sip I had of red wine or something.
No,
there was enough.
How much did it cost?
I'm going to tell you later.
Okay, go ahead.
People are just
continue. Yes,
later.
Go ahead.
All right. I learned this.
What's that?
People actually read the Federal Register.
No, they don't.
The guy next to me in first class had the Federal Register. It was 5 inches thick.
You should say what this is. This is where they publish all proposed regulations
everything.
And the dullest crap
out
of the Federal.
When I say reading it, he had like 15 bookmarks. He was flipping furiously back and forth, page 81, page 881, back, forth. I was fascinated watching the guy.
In first class?
In first class.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was he reading?
Well, should I have asked?
You should have asked.
Well, I was pretty nosy.
Considering what you paid, you should have asked, let me tell you. What else you got?
People read the Federal. All right. This is kind of depressing.
Yeah.
Washington, D.C. is so much cleaner than Boston.
It is.
There are no patchwork quilt streets. There's none of that spray paint everywhere that we do. It's beautiful. Why are we the only first-class city in America that looks like this? Paris doesn't look like this. New York doesn't look like
this. Can I tell you something? Since you don't ride the subway, if you ever rode the Metro in Washington, D.C., it is spotless. First of all, there's no squeaking. There's no sound. They have rubber tires.
I have ridden it.
Yeah, really?
Absolutely.
It is beautiful. They have artwork on the walls.
It's
unbelievable.
It's really nice.
Okay, what else you got?
I also learned that airplane Wi-Fi doesn't work.
What does that mean? You paid for it and you didn't get it?
No, but now this is a whole new thing with phones and, you know, you can bring your stuff and it's supposed to be internet on an airplane.
I understand what Wi-Fi is. I know what it is.
It doesn't work.
Okay, fine. Okay, it doesn't work. It's not that
even
big a deal.
Even in first class, pay all that money.
Okay, we got to go. Now,
all
listen,
right, goodbye.
When I come up later, you can tell me how much it costs?
Maybe.
Okay.
It's gonna race right up there.
Quickly, what are you doing tonight?
So we're doing Mandela, you know, just how even the media has been just so enamored of Nelson Mandela. There's nobody can say a bad word about him. There just isn't anything. And then we're going to take a look at the release of the 911 tapes in Sandy Hook and who decided to air them and why and what kind of justifications various networks gave for that.
And by the way, on Monday, I will tell you how much the first class ticket was. So just tune in. Emily, it's great to see you.
Thank you, Emily Rooney. She is here with us every Friday, and you can see her tonight at 7 o'clock, Beat the Press, and every night on WGBH-TV at 7. Up next is our news quiz. It's going to be comedian versus comedian in a smackdown on the week's news.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And it's time for our Friday news quiz. Here with us in Studio 3, and I have to be honest because we couldn't find anybody else. We called everybody. No one was available. I mean, we had one person, but we didn't want him.
I don't know about the big one, but
our
I'm on
comedians, Chris Tabb, that's his voice. And
How
the other
you,
guy is Corey
America.
Manning. How
that
are you, Corey?
Me. Yes, I'm upset that you called me second after Chris, which means I was the last person that you called.
Actually, it was even worse than that, Corey, but we'll get into that a little bit later. They are the dynamic duo of comedy. They'll be hosting what they describe as, quote, the wildest, most unpredictable comedy show in the city, Black Saturday Holiday Comedy Show.
Yep.
With music by DJ, how do you say this guy's name?
Reggie B.
Big
Chicago.
Whatever. It's next Saturday, December 14th at 8 p.m. at the Shipyard in Quincy. Tickets are only $10. We'll tell you about it, how to get tickets again. Chris Tabb, Corey Manning, great to see you both.
Oh, good to be back, man. Good
how
to be
are you? What's going on, Chris?
Here's what has happened since.
So because you saw your last?
Because of my last appearance.
On the quiz with Corey.
The quiz, one of your listeners reached out to me
and said,
I can't believe you don't have a website. Boom.
You have a website?
Freedom Sites, my man Danny, is hooking me up. Currently, there wasn't enough time to make it sexy.
Hold on.
But Danny from Freedom Sites is hooking me up.
Now, Chris.
Yes.
You're a comedian.
I certainly am.
And you thought that people would get in touch and see what you were doing. How exactly did you think they're going to do that?
Well, with all
website?
The social media out there, I mean, I got people from like fifth grade reaching out to me and everything else. I mean, Facebook and Twitter at Chris Tabb Show. People reach out to me all the
time.
When's this website happening?
The website will be happening, I'm going to say, probably within the next month or so. Yeah. I wanted to do it right. I didn't want to rush it, but because of the Jim and Marjorie show, your listeners,
Before you ask Corey, let me just say,
does.
Promoting something, Chris, that doesn't exist is really effective. No, trust me, it really, really is.
What I was promoting was your listeners.
Okay,
they are passionate.
They are great.
Sorry, you were speaking to Corey. What were you asking
Corey has a website. I figured he's in 2013.
He's still on MySpace. Don't even get it confused.
Actually, it's Black Planet. Thank you very much. I'm trying to keep it into the spirit of things.
Okay.
So you're supposed to say your website. What is it? What is it? What's your deal?
Corey Manning.
Well, that's very basic.
What do you think? I mean, you're fairly friendly with Chris, right?
Oh,
I mean, you are.
I suppose. Yeah.
Okay. He owes me money.
How do you feel about the fact that he still doesn't have a website?
You know what? I understand that because he's trying to, you know, develop himself in the marketing sense.
I see.
It doesn't make any sense, though. It doesn't make any sense to me for a long time. In order for me to call Chris, I used to have to page him.
So I lead a very busy life.
Yeah.
I need someone to manage my social media.
I'm glad somebody's in worse shape than I am.
Before we start this quiz, we know this thing you're doing on December 14th, which is a week from Saturday.
Yes, Black Saturday.
We know that. Is at the Shipyard in Quincy, Corey Manning. But how does one get tickets? Do you have to go to the Shipyard? How do you get tickets? Do you have any idea how to get tickets?
You can see your face. It's at the door.
It's at the door.
Oh, it's at the door. So you just show up and you get tickets.
Show up and get tickets. And
or you could just go to your you don't have a website.
Oh, my That's God. Now, this guy is all over it.
Now, you can actually make phone calls and reserve tickets if you want to do that in case the place sells out. So
the
phone number is 617-
Whoa.
749.
I didn't even know there was a phone number.
6177.
Is that true? Or you're
That's true.
617-749-6177 to reserve tickets to the shipyard in Quincy.
At the shipyard in Quincy.
At the shipyard in Quincy. Not to be confused with the shipyard that's in Quincy.
Right. Okay. It's at the shipyard.
At the shipyard that's...
Okay.
Fine. You ready for the quiz?
Ready for the quiz?
And yes. Any race can come to the show. It's Black Saturday, but anybody can show up.
Oh, yeah.
We should explain that. It's not that you have to be black to get in.
Oh, that's why I wasn't coming, actually.
Of the holidays.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That,
yeah.
You know, it's Black Saturday, so we have a premium show.
You won't get in trouble there, Corey.
Pocket-friendly prices.
There it is.
Okay, well, then I'll think of coming, actually.
Black Friday got a little bit out of control.
Who do you want to do first? So, I mean, who do you want to ask a question of first, Marjorie?
Okay.
That's the wrong thing to say.
Ready, Corey? Ready, Corey?
Corey, take it away.
Why does he go first?
Just let him go.
I'm sorry. You want to go first?
No, please.
Okay.
Big Corey, people ready? First. Okay. Big people first.
You are big. You are big.
Yes,
you
must I am.
Have been. You must have been like a football star, right?
You know what?
He's like 9/11.
I played. Yeah. I was actually a ballerina in high school.
You were not.
Yes, I was. I was a dancer, not ballerina. I didn't wear the tutus because they didn't have one my size.
Yeah,
like a 5'5".
Yeah.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to high school in North Carolina. I'm from North Carolina.
You
Durham,
are?
North Carolina. Yeah.
Oh, that's.
So I went to Durham High School.
Okay.
All the schools I went to are no longer there. I had nothing to do with it.
Okay,
Mr. Ballerina over there.
Here we go.
Earlier this week, there was an important press conference in Boston. Here is a clip.
It really is about hygiene. I think it's time for the gals and the men to start wearing perfumes and colognes. And don't be afraid to be stylish in front of the camera.
Okay. Who was that giving broadcasting advice to aspiring journalists?
I would say that was Mr. Ron Burgundy.
Amen.
Yeah, you are correct. Yes. He was at Emerson College this week. Yes. He was pretty funny, I thought.
He will not be at the shipyard on the 14th.
Why not?
Couldn't book him. He's contract negotiations fell through with him. That's all.
Yeah. By the way, I don't want to make you feel, but he has a website. He
certainly does.
He has a website.
He certainly does.
And he's a character.
Yeah.
He's not even
he
a
does.
Real
That's
person.
Very fictional. That's a great point, Corey.
That's right.
Okay, Chris.
We got to get on this, Danny. We got to get on this.
Chris, you're getting crushed. It's 1-0, Corey Manning
and
at the end of a half round.
And somebody please keep accurate score.
We will.
Please.
The judges are working on this. Don't worry about it. Now, here's your question. Here is Conan O'Brien. He's from Brookline.
Oh.
Who's he talking about in this particular clip, Chris?
Have you heard about this? Going to start delivering stuff by drone, yeah. Which may be why today U.S. forces in Afghanistan began bombarding the Taliban with copies of Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants.
Okay, so the question is, what is Conan O'Brien talking about in this clip?
Amazon.com.
Wow, Chris.
Begin delivering with drones.
What do they call it? The
Octocopters.
What? Octocopters.
How do you feel about that?
You know what? I can't wait to see him deliver flat screen TV by
Octocopter. Yeah. Sounds like a Marvel superhero.
Now let me ask you, if a drone came into your neighborhood, Chris Tabb, what do you think? You know, they're just flying over your neighborhood. It's hovering over your next to your house. What
as
do you think
long
the
as
reaction?
If the drone was the right shade, it wouldn't have a problem.
Okay. I can get a drone for some of the crackheads in my neighborhood for $20. Right.
That was horrible. That was Corey Manning. It was not me. I want to be clear.
No
was.
Drones at the shipyard on the 14th,
okay.
folks. It's
going to no
be
drones.
All human beings.
Correct. The score, 1-1 is the score at the end of one round. Chris Tabb and Corey Manning.
Okay.
No drones.
Corey Manning, here we go. Here's a newscast from earlier this week. Who is reporter Crystal Marine talking about in this clip?
Welcome to The Fumble. I'm Crystal Marine. In nasty news, his old beard hair sold for over $10,000 at an auction recently.
Okay, do you know whose beard's that? Beard hair. So.
Martha Stewart. No, I'm sorry.
Poor Martha.
That's hard.
That was David Ortiz.
David Ortiz, you are correct.
I thought you were going to say Khloe Kardashian.
Good.
Yeah, everybody's got a little weirdness in them. But what do you think of the person who spent? I don't even know if it's anonymous or not. For those who don't know, it's a plexiglass box or glass box with a razor, which was the razor that shaved it, and the stubble from his. I mean, what do you do with that, Corey Manning?
Well, if you're in Mattapan, you can sell it in bundles. It's called weed.
Here's the crazy part.
What's that?
Imagine getting scammed and buying fake David beard. Ortiz
beard, exactly.
Or somebody out there is going to get scammed and have it delivered by a drone.
Synthetic. And where do you put it? Do you put it on the mantelpiece in your living room? Do you have it in the kitchen?
Right next to the potato chip that looks like George Bush.
Yeah.
It's the same guy is going to be buying
this. I have a great idea for you because I know you're a big-time marketer, Chris Tabb.
Let's do it.
You have a mustache of sorts right now, correct?
I do. This is fly. This is GQ.
What if you shaved the mustache?
I don't
put
like
it in
already.
A box with a razor and sold it on the website when the website is created. What do you
listen for folks that join ChrisTabShow.com?
Yeah.
Yes, there will be one blade of hair available from my mustache for registered members of ChrisTabShow.com.
Okay,
by the way, he's giving them out too at the shipyard at Quincy. Now, here's the question: it's 2-1, Corey Manning.
Bring a straight razor to Quincy. I'll let you shave.
I love Jimmy Kimmel. Who is Jimmy Kimmel talking about here? Listen.
Gang members were caught on wiretap saying they have photos of doing heroin, which is weird because I thought he had an exclusive deal with crack. I didn't know. And if that isn't enough, there are allegations tried to buy the infamous video that reportedly shows him smoking crack by offering some gang members $5,000 and a car. Which sounds like he'd make a good game show host.
Who was that, Chris Tabb, to tie the score? This would tie it up at 2.
I'm going to go with the Toronto, or is he the Canadian mayor, Ford?
That is exactly right.
That is correct.
You're right on all counts.
Listen,
Toronto is in Canada, and he's the mayor.
Not for nothing.
Yeah.
Not for nothing.
Yeah.
When that story is all said and done, I am so angry that Chris Farley has passed away.
Oh, who is not? Yes. They had what's the name of the guy who played him on SNL a couple weeks ago? He's good, but it was so much created
that
for Chris Farley to do.
And Chris Farley was working on the Fatty Arbuckle movie, which I think would have been pushed aside for the Canadian mayor movie.
Yeah,
obviously.
Can you imagine?
That is a slam.
If nothing else, Rob
dunk.
Ford looks good, though. Don't you think, you guys? He really has a certain panache or something.
Because he's living in a van down by the river.
I'm just waiting for him and Marion Barry to go on tour. That's all.
Marion Barry is the former mayor of D.C. who also was caught doing a similar thing.
What's he
thing.
Up to?
It's the crack
he
mayor tour.
Crack or
he may
stop.
Still be on the council. I think he's not the mayor. I think he is still on the D.C. council. I'm not sure.
He's getting up there, though.
Ladies and gentlemen,
like
it's the crack
70?
Mayor tour.
He's selling drones.
Hey, can I ask you? I should know this, but I haven't checked Chris's website recently. So is this... This Black Saturday holiday comedy show that you guys are doing together, do you guys ordinarily do stuff together, or is this a one and done? What's
just clean that up. Could you clean
no, I'm
that
serious.
Up
what is,
we,
it's a cup work
of
coffee together? I know you're fairly friendly.
We are a comedy duo. We're the only urban comedy duos in the country, and we've been doing it for like, what, 8 years?
8 years.
Is
there any jealousy, or is there any, what's the feeling between the two of you?
Only when, like, he bombs, you know. I'm jealous.
Listen, you love that, though, don't
very
you?
Very rare.
When I'm not there, I'm jealous
occasion.
That I'm not there to see it.
If I could have my Facebook faithful, if anybody has ever seen me bomb in Massachusetts.
Let's clarify that.
Now, is there one of you that's more domineering than the other? You know, I'm on a talk show.
Marjorie, you take it away.
Someone
he's
who,
not choking me out, Marjorie, if that's what you're asking.
Well, okay.
Only if he pays me.
I guess maybe I should drop that line.
What's safe word.
Some of my greatest times ever I've experienced on stage have been with Corey Manning.
Oh, wow.
Really?
It has been an incredible ride. That's why we say the wildest, most unpredictable, because it's not like we're getting up and kind of going with the script. So I invite anybody with like one leg longer than the other or
anybody
to come on down to the show. We have a great, great time.
Yeah, we should do, Chris. Why don't you tell us what the phone number is where you can reserve tickets? Corey,
thing.
Don't help.
I didn't
go
know
ahead.
There was
what
a
is...
phone number. I didn't know.
Okay, Corey
Manning,
say it again.
The number is 617-749-6177. And in honor of the pledges that you all do here for
WGBH,
anybody that comes to the show on December the 14th, feel free to be able to make a pledge on your behalf.
WGBH
is probably one of the greatest radio stations ever because they've had us on. But please, pledge.
It's beautiful thing. It's Black
pledge.
Saturday holiday comedy
Here's one
show,
thing you guys did not know.
What do we not know?
What do we not know?
I have to throw this in.
Okay.
Yeah. Somebody in this room has appeared on the show Family Feud.
Wait a second.
Bam!
Is that true?
Survey Seth?
Is that really true?
One of the best, most embarrassing moments of my life.
Oh,
meaning
God.
What? Why Listen. Was it great and embarrassing?
Okay, so.
This is Corey Mann.
They won.
We went up, and the question was, name something that a blind farmer might mistakenly milk.
A blonde or a blind?
Blind.
Blind
a blind farmer,
okay.
might mistakenly milk. And the night before, I had been watching Meet the Parents.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's
so I chimed
funny.
In real quickly, and I said a cat.
But they made it to the bonus round.
They made it to the round
to play for the 10
And
grand.
I got to say, I saved the team because the question that saved us
yeah.
was name something you can that a bald guy doesn't have to do.
Bald guy design.
You have to worry about. So, like, I got haircuts or yeah. something that's exciting yeah. about a bald person, yeah. so yeah. not paying for haircuts.
Yeah.
And then the one where either the other team would have a chance to steal or we would win, my final answer, sexy.
Boom. Ooh. Brought it home.
Congratulations, Corey.
Yeah,
good.
It was beautiful. It was beautiful.
So, what do you get for prizes if you win?
There's $20,000. And if you win 5 days in a row, you get a car.
Wow.
Can I tell you something? You're going to get no points for this. It's one of my favorite little presidential anecdotes. So this is true. Which former president, I'll give you a hint, he's still alive, almost always when he saw a bald head, particularly on a member of the military, would rub the person's head, even if he did not know the person. Which president?
I'm going to go with Jimmy Carter.
That would be wrong. Corey Manning?
George Bush?
That which one?
The senior.
That would be wrong as well. George
Junior.
Bush, the little.
He
okay.
did noogies. That's what he called them. Noogies.
It's
like
2-2.
Saturday Night Live, you know?
You're being spicy.
I think a very sweet I've ever heard. That's the most terrifying thing I've ever
terrifying.
Heard.
It's 2-2 at the end of one round. Next question from Marjorie to Corey Manning.
Here we go.
Oh, I've lost my place.
Pledge.
I think it's good. Massachusetts Transportation Secretary Richard.
No, it's nope. actually not.
Oops. Who's Conan O'Brien
That's
talking
it. Yes,
about
thank
here?
You.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Is this the part where I get cheated?
Who is Conan O'Brien talking about here, Corey Manning?
All right.
Said that when he was a student, he worked as a bouncer to earn money. Yeah. Well, it's good to know at least one Catholic official is making sure someone's over 21.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay. What famous Catholic worked as a bouncer for a short time in
wow.
his youth?
Yeah, I'm stumped on that one.
Yeah.
The Pope?
The same family.
The Pope!
The Pope was
you are
a bouncer?
Right. The Pope was a bouncer.
Is that a true
what?
Story? How about That's a little ding, ding, ding for this? Ding, 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 ding. That is
Who
correct,
could believe
Corey.
Man. He's a little guy, too.
No wonder he doesn't need the Pope mobile with all this food.
How much you love this guy? Be serious. Do you not love Pope Francis? What are you texting somebody? What are you doing?
Google it.
Chris Tabb, what is he doing?
Cheating.
I'm making sure I'm being supported in my online world.
Chris Tabb is on live radio. Corey Manning is entertaining us. And the reason Chris Tabb's not participating is he's texting somebody.
That's right.
He's trying to update his website.
Okay.
That's
okay, next question. You're 1 point behind. This is a real tough one. You ready?
Is there a screen there? Is that for you?
Yeah, I got the message. Okay, here is for Chris Tabb. Chris.
Pledge.
Keith Olbermann probably made Red Sox fans feel a little bit better this week when he said the following words.
The New York Yankees just paid $153 million for an outfielder who, of the last 731 regular season days, has spent 249 of them on the disabled list. The New York Yankees just gave the 17th largest total value contract in baseball history to a guy who hit just under half of all of his career home runs during one season.
Just shut up already. It was endless. Okay, here's the question, Chris Tapp. Who did the Yankees pay $153 million to?
Oh, my God.
Well, no.
Can I help him?
No. You don't
Kanye
know
West.
This is Kanye West.
I think Kanye West hits better than this guy.
You don't know the answer.
I
to this
do
question?
Know the answer. Amazing. Jacoby Ellsbury.
That is
Very
exactly
good.
Correct.
Very good.
Now, okay. by the way, even he's Native American. Can he come to the Black Saturday holiday comedy show?
Jacoby is
on
welcome.
December 14th.
And he can buy a table.
He could
I think
buy a
he
table.
Could get
several
a table of
tables.
Ten. He's good to go.
$153 million.
I wonder what his beard's going for.
Yeah. Now, let me explain this to you. You are tied at the end of regulation. Corey Manning and Chris. Chris Tabertai. We're going to the bonus round. Now, here's the deal.
There we go.
Since you're both in the profession of making people laugh, we're going to ask you about nitrous oxide, commonly known as laughing gas. You better ace this because we did the exact same bonus round with you last time. You were here, and if you don't get this right, it's going to be humiliating. Okay. Now, let me just be clear here. Whoever does better in the bonus round is the winner of everything. You understand that? This is
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, go ahead, Marty.
I have people listening nationwide.
No, it's huge.
I'll have
this
that nationwide.
Okay, multiple choice, Chris. You ready? How did the first pioneer of laughing gas describe what it felt like to be under the influence? A, what joy, what rapture? B, exultation has claimed every fiber of my body and spun me out a happy drunk. Or C, a thrilling game on, and uneasiness was for a few minutes swallowed up in pleasure.
Wow.
No, it's a tough one.
Take your time. We're not going anywhere.
I think I'm turned on.
me too.
It is great stuff out here.
It got kind of warm in here.
How come you're not doing one of these?
Oh God, that's what you're supposed to do when someone's talking.
My.
Okay, what's the answer?
I'm going to go with C.
You are correct.
Now, you know we're going to do that, lend some excitement
for Chris Tabb. Come and check me December 14th on nitrous oxide.
Now, here's the deal. Now, actually, this question, last final bonus question, is worth only 1 point, which would tie it up, but that's not that exciting. Okay. So this is worth 2 points, Corey.
Two points.
You get this right, you crush your friend. And I'm sorry, Chris. I got to bring a little excitement to this match.
I win the game.
You win everything.
The rights to the website.
And the rights to the website. That's right.
Danny, lock down the...
Okay, ready? Here it is. Who is Danny, by the way? Who
Danny is my guy at Freedom Sites, who I told you was a...
Okay, you've only said the name of the company like 11 times. Can I please speak to Corey Manning? Corey.
Yes, sir.
Laughing gas has made its way into pop culture. Which among these three is true? Let me be clear. You get it right, you win the whole thing. You get it wrong, and Chris Tabb wins. You understand?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
Here we go.
The Ramones wrote, "I want to be sedated after a wild night of nitrous oxide shots." B, that's A. B, laughing gas was an animated film featuring a walrus who is afraid to have his tooth pulled. Or C, laughing gas was the short-lived line of menswear owned by Harry Hamlin. Is it A, the Ramones, B, the walrus thing, or C, the Harry Hamlin-related thing? Is it A, B, or C?
Oh, man, no idea. Let's go because I try to keep drugs away from the young people.
That's good.
All right, let's go with B.
Let me tell you right now, Chris Tabb, your friend Corey Manning is the winner of this week's quiz. Right now, it's unfair.
I get your website. The Chris Tabb Show. Okay, formerly really known as the Chris Tabb Show.com.
Now, if you want to file,
this is a family show.
That's right.
Can I tell you something? You can file a complaint if you want, because we really nailed you on this thing. Chris, if you want to file a complaint, because we gave
him
a...
filing with the FC, FBI,
exactly.
NAACP,
now,
and
Chris,
everybody else.
We will allow you, since you are the loser here, we will allow you to say the Black Saturday Holiday Comedy Show is when again, and what happens at this? Where is this?
December 14th.
Right,
if
next
you
want
to come out and see premium comedy, one of the wildest, most unpredictable comedy shows ever, with one of the greatest DJs in the country, Big Chicago, Reggie B's, hosted by the dynamic duo of comedy. We are putting up their stand-up. There's going to be some sketch and just complete unpredictability. Bring your mama, bring your dad, bring your friends. Two VIP seats for Jim and Marjorie.
Thank you.
It's a deal.
If you guys want to come on down, we'll bring you on
stage. I can sell them probably for $10.
If you want to scalp tickets, that would be one of the greatest accomplishments we've ever had.
Chris Tabb, we love you. We can't wait for the website. Corey Manning. What's your website? CoreyManning.com.
Love that. Facebook. Google me. Corey Manning. Twitter.
Right to the
why wouldn't we?
Right to the point.
And just love you both.
For the address, it's 132 East Howard Street, 617-749-6177 to make your reservation.
You are on
Pledge.
Speaking of pledge, by the way, the number again, if you would like to pledge, is 888-897-9424. Go to WGBHnews.org. You're going to love this, Marjorie. Anonymous in Cambridge says, quote, "Since I listen to you every day, I figure that a buck a day is a very good deal. I'm very glad Jim and Marjorie are on the air now. Thanks to a donor in Hyde Park. We heard from Dorothy in Hingham. There are tons. Marsha in Wabun. Is that how you say it, Newton?
Wabun. Yeah, okay.
Michael in West Roxbury. Martha in West Falmouth. I can't say anymore. Thank you all. We really appreciate it.
We want to apologize to Nicholas Davidoff. He was going to join us today to talk about collision low crossers a year inside the turbulent world of the NFL of NFL football. He'll be with us on Monday along with a lot of other stuff. Our show's production, WG.